Du lytter til Fitness MK. Det er programmet for os, der træner. Vi er nået til afsnit nummer ikke mindre end 300. Det betyder, at jer, der har fulgt med fra start af, I har brugt over 400 timer på det her skrald. Skam jer. Men i anledning af, at vi er kommet til afsnit nummer 300, så har jeg fundet noget ganske særligt til jer. Og det er ingen ringere end Patrick Arnold. Han er måske sådan verdens førende dopingpirat, kan man sige, og han har bevidst eller ubevidst fået gjort det til sit professionelle virke og være en tårn i øjet på verdens og måske specielt Amerikas eller USA's antidopingmyndigheder. Det er blandt andet ham, der har fundet det stimulans, der hedder DMAA, som der var i det her meget stærke pre-workout Jack 3D. Som gav en masse ballade, som fandtes, det var sådan ligesom en meget potent version af koffein, nok i virkeligheden tættere på amfetamin eller kokain, som der fandtes i pre-workout kosttilskud. Det var hans opfindelse. Det er også hans opfindelse, det hele det konceptet af prohormoner. Man indtager stoffer, der bliver lavet om til mere, eller det udlignende stoffer, der når man indtager dem, bliver lavet om til mere biologisk aktive substanser. Og han var også en af aktørerne i det, der hedder Belko-skandalen, som nok er den største skandale med organiseret doping i USA, som blandt andet Barry Bonds, som nogle af jer måske kender som ham, der har lavet flest home runs i verdenshistorien i Major League Baseball. Også CJ Hunter, meget kendt atletik, kvindelig atletikstjerne, en masse hockeyspillere, flere baseballspillere og nogle atletikfolk også. Og der var han en af dem, der var involveret i det. Og en af de ting, der kom ud af det, det var blandt andet, at man opdagede en række helt nye steroider. Eller kan man sige, antidopingmyndighederne opdagede en række helt nye anabole steroider, som det altså var Patrick Arnold, der enten havde opfundet eller genfundet i nogle gamle patentdatabaser. Og det må man sige, det er et stort, møgbeskidt og meget fascinerende fodaftryk at sætte på idrætshistorien. Og jeg har prøvet lang tid på at få Patrick Arnold i tale, og det er svært at beskrive. Han er en vild type, det må man sige. Når I kommer til at høre interviewene her om lidt, eller interviewstykkerne om lidt, så vil det også fremgå, at det er han. Det giver måske sig selv, at for, ligesom at have den historie, for at have de feeds, så skal man også være en vild type. jeg kunne desværre kun... en af de her vildhedsting, det var blandt andet, at da vi skulle, det var svært at få landet interviewet til at starte med, fordi han har en speciel facon. Og den første gang, der kan jeg sige, at den første gang, vi havde en aftale, der ligesom var faldet på plads, der var nødt til at aflyse, fordi han havde haft et laboratorieuheld, der gjorde, han ikke var i stand til at gennemføre interviewet. Jeg har lovet ikke at sige, hvad det var, men fordi det var dumt. Men det er en af tingene. Han er også... det kunne ikke lade sig gøre at kunne få en internetforbindelse til ham, så det er altså over telefon. Det beklager jeg selvfølgelig. Det gør, at der er noget forsinkelse på, og det gør også, at lyden ikke er så god igen, som den kunne have været. Vi har prøvet på at rense så meget op i det, som nogle gange kunne lade sig gøre, men det er, som det nogle gange er. Han har også haft en eller anden form for sygdom eller skade i hjernen. Jeg ved ikke helt, hvad det er, som han skal ofte lede efter ord, og det kan man også godt lægge mærke til i løbet af interviewet. Hvad kan man sige, vi blev ikke færdige den første gang, jeg skulle interviewe ham, og derfor så skulle vi have en anden runde i stand, og det kunne ikke lade sig gøre at få den færdiggjort interviewet her, inden vi skulle lave nummer 300, så vi brækker det op i to, og jeg tror måske i virkeligheden, at det er meget praktisk, fordi man kan godt blive lidt træt, eller det kan godt være sådan lidt hårdt at lytte på den her telefonforbindelse i lang tid. Så det er det. Jeg er selvfølgelig jeres vært, Anders Nedergaard, og jeg kan med stor glæde, fornøjelse og stolthed præsentere Patrick Arnold, som er, hvad skal man kalde det, performance chemist. Til jer, der lytter med, der kan man selvfølgelig skrive ind til podcasten på afn@andersnedergaard.dk eller på programmets Facebook-side eller Instagram. Og her i den første bid af interviewet med ham, der hører vi ligesom om hans origin story, hvor han fortæller om sin barndom og ligesom det, der leder ham hen på den vej, hvor han er. Undervejs der fortæller han lidt om, han har gået til wrestling i skolen. Der skal man selvfølgelig huske på, at wrestling i USA, det er ikke den slags wrestling i hvert fald. Det er ikke sådan noget pro rollespils wrestling med mærkelige backstories, det er jo det, der hedder college-brydning, som er en form for brydning, der minder lidt om græsk-romersk brydning. Det kendes fra Danmark også. Så ja, lad os ikke med i gang. So, if with any luck, I've got Patrick Arnold at the other end of the line here. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, excellent. Thank you very much for taking the time to talk to me and the listeners of the Fitness MK podcast here. I consider this somewhat of a scoop, considering all the stuff that you've been involved with during your time. Can you give a brief presentation of yourself to the listeners that may not know you?
Well, I'm Patrick Arnold, and I currently reside in Central Illinois. I've been out here since 1996. Previous to that, I was in graduate school on a PhD program. I had finished my coursework, and before I commenced my thesis, I had a business opportunity because I was very much interested in the nutritional supplement, especially the sports supplement industry, due to the fact that there was a legislation passed in 94, which greatly opened up an avenues to market novel things. And I had kind of grown an encyclopedia of potential compounds in my brain that could be sold as nutritional supplements, amongst other things. And I also had the ability to chemically synthesize things. And, you know, it's sort of a fate had it that there was somebody out here that knew somebody that knew somebody. And I was able to come out here, and it was kind of awkward, but I did hook up with a person here who had business experience. He also had the ability to manufacture reactors and other things on a pilot and production scale, and there was a remnant of a lab here as well that someone had left, and I got here, and I turned that lab into eventually a, you know, pretty decent lab, and developed some stuff. And eventually, we bought a new building, and then that was around 2003. But that is just my history as far as people know me in the nutritional supplement and performance enhancing world.
Yeah,
I didn't include parts about my youth or anything like that. I mean, if you want to ask questions about that, that's fine. If not, we can.
Well, I would like to know about the youth because, you know, the paths that people end up on usually they start out pretty early. How old are you now?
54.
Okay, where were you born?
New Haven, Connecticut.
Okay, and where? And okay, so I mean, it seems evident that you like have an interest in anabolics, and how did you get interested in the whole like muscle thing? Did you start working out at a young age, like most American age men your age did, or how did that come around?
Well, when I was around, I don't know, 10, 11 years old, my grandfather gave us a bunch of old weights that he had in his basement, and my brothers and I put together a little mini gym in our cellar, and we started to lift weights. We didn't really know what we were doing, so we went out and bought some books on it. And also went to a place in a town called Wallingford, Connecticut, that was next to a foundry, iron foundry.
Yeah, yeah.
And there was a guy there that, made custom-made benches and creature curls and other squat racks and stuff like that. And, you know, we saved our money and bought different pieces, and we had a pretty decent gym. That was really pretty stuff. Because, you know, this guy didn't fool around when it came to welding some heavy-ass...
Nice.
Benches and everything. Yeah, it was so good.
Was that in the countryside or in the city?
What's that?
Was that in the countryside or did you live in the city?
Suburbs.
Okay.
Suburbs. It was not, well, where I am right now is country. I would not call, Wallingford is a suburb kind of somewhere between New Haven and Hartford. And it's really, you know, it's got industry there. It's not definitely not a farming community like it is out here in Illinois.
So,
but I was going to make a point. Back then, this would have been around, you know, the mid 70s, and people lifting weights was still a novel thing, or young people lifting weights was a novel thing. There weren't a lot of gyms around. People in sports, football, and other sports, normally didn't lift weights as part of their training. That didn't come around until later. Now it's, you know, every high school or something has a weight room, and every, you know, just about every sport does some sort of resistance training. But we were one of the first, definitely first in our neighborhood to have a, you know, weights in a gym, and if people would come over, they'd be curious and they get into it too. So I gained a knowledge about weightlifting, bodybuilding, and also nutrition and everything related to fitness, especially muscle growth.
Yeah.
At a pretty young age. So I had a, you know, kind of a head start.
Were you good at it?
Was I good at it?
Like getting stronger and I mean, I know that I'm notoriously bad.
Well, definitely. Well, I was persistent, and my brother had better genes than I did, so he got strong. Well, I was the youngest anyway, but he definitely responded more than I did. But yeah, I got stronger for sure. You know, anyone that works out and is disciplined about it and has a good diet, they're going to get stronger. And as I grew into my later teens, I noticed that I was on the wrestling team. I noticed that I had a much bigger advantage over other people on the team because they didn't lift weights. So I was able to throw them around more efficiently.
Yeah. 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 And my next question would have been if you got into any athletics, but it sounds like, yeah, you got into the wrestling thing. Was that the only thing?
Well, I play a little baseball. I played a little football until I tore my hamstring,
yeah, it happens.
I didn't want. Yeah, and plus, wrestling was so exhausting. I just saved my energy for the wrestling season.
Did you get any? I mean, wrestling is known for being notoriously rough and injury-inducing, unless you've got some kind of extreme resiliency, you know, type. But did you get out of it unscathed?
Well, I think that my neck has been permanently damaged. In fact, right now I can't move my head because
that's
I just woke up the wrong way on the pillow last weekend, and I needed to get rubbed out or something. But yeah, I went to a wrestling camp, and somebody had me in a position. I pushed down on my head or something, and and it just was, that was the initiated the whole thing, and that same muscle strain keeps recurring. And it's been recurring for 40 years, I guess.
Yeah.
Oh well.
It'll do that. Yeah. So, I mean, how many brothers did you have? Or do you have
two older brothers? Okay. They're both around.
And did you come out of a family with any science background? Or were parents into like STEMs?
My parents were educators, but they weren't in the sciences.
Okay.
And my brothers weren't in the... Well, my brother graduated with a mechanical engineering degree, but he went into sales and marketing. He never wanted to be a mechanical engineer, but he needed some science background to at least get him in the door to a company that required some technical knowledge. So he made a good choice, and he planned his life ahead from a very early stage. It took me a while to kind of figure out where I was going.
So what was the, is there any defining moment that put you towards performance, nutrition, chemistry?
Well, I was always interested in it as a teenager.
From a practical, applied perspective?
Well, mostly nutrition stuff.
Yeah.
And also training stuff. And I later had to decide what my major would be in college. And I originally wanted to do pharmacy, pharmacology, because I always found the potential of drugs and just how drugs work to be fascinating in the body. And I wasn't able to get into the pharmacy school at this university, but I was able to get into chemistry school, and I'm very glad that I did that, because then I was able to specialize in organic synthesis, which allows me to make stuff, which kind of became ultimately my passion and kind of led me to be able to do the things that I did that propelled me to success in the nutritional supplement industry, and also to gain some notoriety and doing things on the side. We're probably going to talk about, I'm sure.
Yeah. How did you first encounter PEDs? Like, from a practical perspective,
or even hear about them? There was a sports book on training, weight training, and other training, and it was a decent book at the time. And there was one half a page discussed anabolic steroids, and it basically said that you don't want to touch these; are bad, they don't work, and so stay away. And, to any kid, at least they don't do something that kind of puts up a big red flag. It puts out a big alarm saying, oh, this is probably interesting.
Yeah.
Because when authorities tell you not to do something, then so this must be something good.
Yeah.
Or bad, or both. So that's when I remembered the term anabolic steroids, and in later years I looked into that, and then I started going to a gym, graduating from our basement, and I noticed that some of the people at that gym were just monsters, and I kind of heard that they were on these steroids and all that. So
when was that?
It would have been around 1982 or 1983.
Okay.
When I was still in high school.
Yeah. What was the culture around that stuff in the States at the time? Did people know to what extent they were used, and how was it looked upon?
Oh, people outside of the gym culture really didn't know anything about it, except maybe the stuff that they would hear around the time of the Olympics. A scandal with East Germany and the women that, won all the medals and looked like men. But other than that, it really wasn't until I think around 1988 with the Ben Johnson scandal that the general public had a more widespread awareness of the drug.
The reason I'm asking is because the culture and the and the way that society looks upon steroids in Denmark has, I think, always been more stigmatized. Steroids have always been more stigmatized in Denmark than they have in pretty much any other country in the world, but at least a lot more than in the States. So, I mean, if even back then, bodybuild in the 80s and the 90s in Denmark, bodybuilding was considered somewhat of a narcissistic endeavor, much more than in Germany or Sweden, for that matter. So it was if a guy with big arms came walking down the street, and people would sometimes he would be kind of frowned upon. Whereas if he did that in Texas, people would come and feel up his biceps and ask how he was doing his training. So that's the reason why I'm asking.
Well, America, especially Texas, it's a much different culture than Europe. Europe obviously had to go through the World War II and the Nazis and their eugenics theory of the superhuman. So I don't know if that has had vibrations down the decades afterwards, and maybe they look at people like that as having that.
I think that's a very specific Danish thing, because if you just go to Germany, it's much more like the States. So I mean, there's a lot of possible reasons, but it's if you just go to Germany or Sweden, it's very different. So, I mean, it's just Denmark that's weird, really weird about that stuff, but that's just the way it is, I guess. You got into chemistry in college?
Yeah, I started off as a chemistry major. Yeah. And I didn't know where I would go with it. And eventually I gravitated towards organic chemistry, yeah, and organic synthesis. And I got my bachelor's degree. I graduated. I went to New Jersey to have a job at a company called ISP. And it's sort of a competitors of BASF, which is a European-based company, and they basically called a specialty chemical company. They make unique compounds via a pipeline of things that start from a specific commodity compound that they developed, and then they continually find different derivatives of that and applications for that.
Det var Patrick Arnolds origin story, om man vil. Her i den næste bid med ham, den anden bid med ham, der begynder vi at høre om hans første eksperimenter med at begynde at syntetisere ulovlige stoffer. Undervejs der kommer vi til at støde på begrebet PEDs. Det står selvfølgelig for Performance Enhancing Drugs, som er sådan en fælles betegnelse for alle dopingstoffer. På et tidspunkt er der også en reference til Dominic Agostino, som er en af dem, han arbejder for nu. Og har Dominic, han er kendt inden for området, der er sådan noget ketosediæt og ketosefysiologi. Og Patrick arbejder med at lave ketonsalte som kosttilskud for ham. Og de er altså ikke ulovlige, bare lige for god ordens skyld. Og i segmentet her, det bliver en lille smule nørdet, vi kommer til at snakke lidt om organisk syntese, altså om hvordan han rent praktisk gør, når han syntetiserer de her stoffer. Fordi det er jo sådan, at når man laver organisk syntese, så starter man med et eller andet udgangspunkt, og så laver man en eller anden reaktion på det. Og når man har lavet den reaktion, så skal man oprense produktet. Nogle gange så kommer der flere forskellige produkter ud. Så skal man ofte oprense det, så man kun ligesom har det ønskede produkt. Så laver man en ny syntese, og så videre igennem x antal trin, indtil man har det ønskede produkt. Og imellem trinene, der kan det også godt være, at man skal gøre et eller andet for at finde ud af, om det produkt, man har fået ud af reaktionen, det rent faktisk er det, man gerne vil have, for ellers bygger man jo videre på noget, der er defekt. På den måde, der er sådan noget syntesekemi ligesom sådan et ekstremt bøvlet Lego-sæt, eller en meget, meget, ligesom at lave banæssauce, kunne man sige, ikke? Bare at man skal bygge videre på banæssaucen bagefter. Så det snakker vi lidt om, sådan de praktiske elementer i. Det starter her.
I had a really boring job. I didn't have much to do all day, and my boss was never there. And there was a chemistry library on my floor, so I'd often venture into the chemistry library and just start looking things up. And then I started making stuff in the lab because he was, was not.
While you were at work?
What was that?
So you're like messing around in the lab at work?
Yeah.
Okay, nice.
I was.
That's beautiful. So by the last final question about the training stuff, did you ever compete in bodybuilding and stuff like that? Did you any do any PEDs yourself?
Yeah, I mean, eventually I did. Actually, I have a funny story. The first time I ever did anything and didn't know what the hell I was doing was a sophomore in high school, and I had a biology class, and I would go into the storage room where the biology teacher had some chemicals and other bottles of stuff. And I noticed there was a bottle of testosterone propionate, but it was for rats.
Ooh.
And it was only like 10 milligrams per milliliter or something like that. And I stole it. And then I went to a doctor, and when the doctor, I was waiting for the doctor to come into the room, I stole some syringes. Nice. And I started taking this testosterone. I didn't know what I was doing at all or how much I was taking. And it was at 10 milligrams per milliliter. It couldn't have been that much, but I definitely got a very noticeable effect from it. And I became a lot stronger. Because I think that was, when you're at that age, I mean, you can respond to very, very small doses of anabolic. And then I didn't touch anything again until I was, let me think, around 20 years old.
Okay.
And then I got a bottle that was labeled anabolic. But I found out later it was probably methyl testosterone. But no, I really got super strong on that. And then it was some years later that I did some more things. But I have a lot of natural training under my belt, more or less, before I got into PED use in a what you would call a standard or more serious way.
Yeah. So is it, can I ask you, is it something you're still doing on and off, or have you stopped that stuff now?
I still do testosterone replacement, not all the time.
Okay.
I don't want to go too much into it, but I did have an injury, a brain injury, and it's had a lot of effects on me, and one of them is it's very hard for me to train intensely. Okay. I get a lot of vertigo.
Oh, okay. So we've got some kind of training intolerance. Damn.
Yeah, training tolerance is very low. I hope that it resolves itself, because training has always been a passion of mine, and it keeps me psychologically able and, well, not that I'm unstable without it, but it gives me energy and puts me in a good state of mind. So it's been an adjustment not being able to train like I used to.
Yeah.
I miss it, obviously.
That's got to suck. I'm guessing that Dominic Agostino is helping you out with some stuff concerning that.
Well, I'm aware of the technology that he's aware of as far as ketones go. And, you know, I use ketones.
Yeah.
To help the recovery. However, they can only do so much. And I don't think Dominic knows has any other tricks up his sleeve, but I know many other people that are very proficient in the area of neurology and supplementation. So there's other things that I take, but there is going to be no magic bullet. I know that.
I got a concussion from wakeboarding last summer.
Yeah,
and that still lingers.
Oh, you got
well.
A concussion.
Yeah, I'm probably got some mild TBI, but I know a little bit of that. So back to the messing around at the lab at work. What were you messing around with back there?
In New Jersey?
Yeah.
I was trying to make some simple anabolic steroids like testosterone, anything that I could make from the available precursors that I could get through commercial vendors.
Okay.
Sigma Aldrich.
Okay, so what is that? Cholesterol?
Okay, go ahead.
So what precursors were you trying to synthesize it from?
Well, that's what I was just about to say. DHEA,
okay.
Epi and Drosterone.
Yeah.
What else? Adrostadiendione, which is a well-known precursor.
Yeah.
There were some more things I could get that were progesterones. And it took me a while to figure out what was available, what was not. And I was able to make some stuff and follow it by a gas chromatograph.
Yeah.
And roughly have an idea of what I got. And I was also making some recreational stuff on the side.
Nice.
Yeah, well, that was a big mistake.
How come? Oh, did they punk you for it?
I was making methadone, which is an opioid.
Yeah.
And I just didn't realize, or I just didn't believe the dangers of addiction and how quickly they can overcome you. So, yeah, that ended up becoming a big demon for me.
Okay.
And I did a job over that, and it was, I had to seek treatment, and it was pretty hellacious.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's real. I guess that's more trial and error than most people get in the chemistry lab. Synthesizing these things, was it difficult to? I mean, I know that the synthetic is available in the literature, and I mean, but is it difficult to do like the practical aspects of it?
Yes, it is.
Okay,
and you have try many different procedures. For a specific compound, you can look up things in the literature, patents, journal articles, where they discuss different synthetic methods.
Yeah.
And some of them work better than others, and especially with patents, what is written in the patent doesn't always work in the lab, because people, even though they file patents on specific methodologies, they still put little, you know, roadblocks in there, or they don't write it quite.
Oh, but that's a reason for that.
They do it because they don't want somebody to steal their technology.
Yeah, yeah.
So they're able to get a patent, yet they just give an extreme example of a synthesis that really doesn't work if you try it.
Yeah.
And also, you have to just keep plugging away until you find something that works. So you may have to, you know, try a procedure or different procedures 10, 15 times before you get it down to where you have a relatively pure and usable product.
Yeah. So, I mean, back in the day, I believe they synthesized testosterone from diosgenin, this plant derived sterol. Have you ever tried doing that?
I did. That was a stupid thing to do, because I could have just bought DHEA or androstenedione.
Yeah,
which is like one step away,
okay,
depending on your method. But yeah, when I first was trying to make testosterone, I bought some diosgenin extract, and I just realized that was a complete mess. And that taught me a lesson. It's like, always find something you could buy that's as close chemically to the substance that you want to make, and don't don't try to start to make something from, you know, from scratch. Don't reinvent the wheel. You know what I mean?
Yeah, from a pharmacology historical perspective. I mean, that's a good. It's a good thing to know. I know how to do at least. I think. I mean, for knowing the trade and craft and all that stuff, I guess. But that's an aesthetic point more than a factual one. So when you're buying the precursors, I mean, I can't remember when did normal anabolic steroids became regulated. When did they become regulated by law in the States?
In 1990. And that was just around the time that I started my first job out of college.
Yeah.
But the precursors were not regulated.
Not at all.
Many of them now. No, I was able to buy them through commercial supply companies.
Okay. Interesting.
And eventually a lot of the stuff that I used to make things like testosterone that I later sold as pro hormones.
Yeah.
And that was after I left that job and I came out here and DHEA was becoming very popular and it was legal under the newly established DSHEA law, which is a United States law that greatly opened up the nutritional supplement industry to introduce new products without much oversight.
Yeah.
So yeah. That's when I introduced the interesting diet. Later, it went on to other more effective derivatives and analogs of that.
So when you were synthesizing stuff in the lab, was that out of professional curiosity or for personal use, or were you distributing stuff back then? Or
it was out of of course I was curious, but it was for personal use, and I didn't even tell anyone that I knew that I was doing that.
Okay.
In fact, I had a girlfriend at the time, and I had all this in my apartment. I had all these patents and literature on hormones, and she says, "What is this? What is this?" And I said, "Well," she said, "Are you making drugs? Are you making steroids?" And I'm like, "Just don't!" And she just got freaked out. That would never happen today because when she was,
that is pretty funny.
Now the girls I meet, they want steroids.
Damn. What kind of yields is it possible to make? Like I mean, I'm guessing those were pretty small setups, right? What kind of yields was it possible to get?
Well, it completely depends upon what you're banking.
Yeah.
And what you start from, it could be if it's a one step synthesis, and it's a relatively easy procedure. You can get 70-80% yield. If it's a multi-step procedure, you may get like a 20% yield. So I try to avoid anything that's that low because I don't want to do four steps and then end up with a very small amount of stuff. But you know, that's a synthesis question that
So it
basically just varies widely.
Yeah.
Considering what you're trying to make.
So, but I mean, what kind of amounts were you dealing with? A couple of 100 milligrams, or a couple of like a single?
No. I wouldn't attempt anything if I were to get any less than about a gram, because when you get less than that and you try to filter it and wash it, and then you'd have to take some to do melting point tests and gas chromatography. And if you don't make a gram at least, then you're not going to end up with enough stuff to work with if you actually want to test it yourself.
And what kind of spectroscopy and chromatography tools did you use to characterize the compounds between synthesis steps?
When I worked in New Jersey, I was limited to gas chromatography. I didn't have a, there was no tandem GC mass spec available at the time.
No.
I had NMR.
Yeah.
I could do IR spectroscopy, but I never felt the need to do that. And for some things, I would rely upon a melting point. But that's only if I was, their other methods wouldn't work, or just if I wanted to be extra careful and wanted confirmation.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, you would have to do the NMR spectroscopy in order to actually, I mean, the gas chromatography would not be enough to get anything from, other than mass and charge and stuff like that. So you would.
Well, you get a peak, and yeah. When you're pretty much, you know, the peak of your starting material, and then another peak shows up, and maybe a couple of others, and then you know enough about the chemistry of what you're doing, you could pretty much guess what those other peaks are.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And so sometimes gas chromatography was enough. Like, for instance, if I was going to make testosterone, from Andro, androstenedione, by a really kind of laborious process, but it was one step, I could see the testosterone peak, and I also saw the emergence of a couple of other impurities, and they actually ended up being 4-androstenediol isomers, which to me was, they were garbage. I didn't want them in there, but I would do a subsequent back oxidation that was selective and get rid of them. But it was years later when I was in the supplement industry that I remembered that 4-androstenediol was a result of over-reduction of, or 4-androstenediol isomers were a result of over-reduction of androstenedione, and they did occur naturally in the body, and they had better conversion than androstenedione to testosterone. And that's when I was like, wow, I could just make this stuff and it would be the second generation prohormone, which is what I did. It's kind of funny because the stuff that was garbage for me ended up becoming kind of gold later.
Yeah. Interesting. So when did you get out of the boring day job, or how did that change happen?
Well, I told you that I made that methadone, and it caught me, and I had to leave that job and suffer the, you know, getting clean.
Og det var så historien om, hvordan Patrick han begyndte at syntetisere ulovlige stoffer på sit arbejde, og undervejs fik en metadon-habit. Men her i det næste segment, som er sådan lidt længere, der kommer vi til at dække det der tema, ligesom det her med prohormoner. Så det handler om, hvordan han bliver en del af internet, altså det bodybuilding-miljø, der findes på internettet i USA på det tidspunkt, igennem noget, der hedder Usenet, eller det, man kalder for newsgroups, som desværre er et format, der ikke findes længere. Hvordan han bliver venner med Dan DeChain, som jo har været sådan et kæmpe ikon i bodybuilding-scenen i mange, mange år. Jeg kommer lige med lidt kontekst herinde. Det var sådan, at steroider, de blev ulovlige i USA i 1990. At det blev lovligt betød ikke, at man sådan begyndte aktivt at efterforske og snakke noget ved det. Det var sådan, altså det var kun noget, der dukkede op sådan som bifangst. Jeg ved ikke, hvor stor en konsekvens det i virkeligheden havde for brugen, men det gjorde, at før det, der var der mange, der det simpelthen kunne købe ting, de havde på apoteket, og det stoppede selvfølgelig med den her lov. Og samtidig med, så blev der lavet en lov, der i praksis satte kosttilskudsindustrien fri. Det var i 1994, og den havde en konsekvens, at Før det, der har man haft nogle regler omkring kosttilskud, der minder om dem, man har i Danmark, hvor dem, der markedsfører kosttilskud, skal dokumentere, at de er sikre. Hvor det mere eller mindre blev sådan bagefter, at det var myndighederne, der skulle have vist, at de var usikre, for man ikke måtte markedsføre dem. Sådan, det er lidt sat på spidsen, men det var det, der ændrede. Det gjorde lige pludselig, at kosttilskudsmarkedet i USA på det tidspunkt blev et slaraffenland. Og det er lidt konteksten for det her med prohormoner, som vi kan snakke om i det næste segment. Det er jo sådan, at når kroppen selv skal syntetisere kønshormoner og de andre steroidhormoner, vi har, så bliver de dannet igennem en række af syntesetrin ind i kroppen. Så hvor at for eksempel for kønshormonerne, altså for næsten alle steroidhormonerne, starter med kolesterol, som så bliver lavet om til en ting, så bliver lavet om til en anden ting, og en tredje ting, indtil man ender med et af de mange produkter, som det kan ende til. Og det var sådan, at eftersom anabole steroider, de er blevet ulovlige i den her periode, så opstod det her fænomen prohormoner. Prohormon, det er et stof, som der, når man indtager det, så bliver det kørt igennem kroppens eget synteseapparat og lavet om til et andet stof med en formodet mere aktiv, biologisk aktiv profil. Og det var simpelthen Patrick Arnold, der var ophavsmand til det begreb. Og det blev også ophav til nogle produkter, som der i Danmark i slutningen af 90'erne blev solgt som 1AD for eksempel. Og de blev altså først ulovlige i 2005. Man fandtes faktisk i butikker, eller fandtes sådan helt ind til 2006-2008 faktisk rundt omkring i verden. Undervejs i løbet af det næste segment her, der snakker han et par gange, og der kommer til at snakke et par gange om DHEA, som er et naturligt forekommende hormon, som også er et meget svagt prohormon. Altså det er et af de ting, der bliver lavet, kan blive lavet om til testosteron eller østrogen i kroppen. Og DHAS, det er sådan en sulfat udgave af det, hvor han skal fortælle, hvordan at hans chef kan lade ham til at lave det der DHAS, det om til DHEA. Som jo også, det er også en slags prohormonarbejde, kan man sige. Men det er ligesom den første tårn i øjet, kan man sige, der kommer i øjet på antidopingmyndighederne. Ikke kun i USA, men faktisk i hele verden. I slutningen af segmentet, der kommer vi også til at snakke om den type af dopingstoffer, der hedder SARM'er, som står for selektiv androgen receptor modulator, som ligesom har været den farmakologiske industris seneste forsøg på at lave anabole steroider. Så når man taler om SARMs, så er det altså den her slags ny anabole steroider-agtige ting. Anyways, segmentet det starter her.
And I had been taking graduate courses at a university in
while working.
New Jersey. What's that?
While you're working.
While I was working at night, yeah. And also coming back at the lab at night. I was pretty busy going to the gym. So I was pretty busy, guys. So that I went home and I started taking graduate courses at University of Connecticut. And doing some stuff in the lab there, and was there about a year or so, and then that's when the internet was burgeoning, and I got on some discussion groups, and met a lot of very important people in the industry, including the guy that I always read his. I always read his material, his books, his articles. His name was Dan Duchesne.
Yeah, yeah.
And only the older users might be familiar with him, but he was a very big deal back in the day. And he quickly took note of my knowledge of chemistry and my knowledge of steroids that had been developed that no one had ever heard of. And he took me under his wing, I suppose, and I saw the opportunity, because this was around the same time that the law that liberated the supplement industry to be able to introduce a lot of things that we'd never even think could be introduced in supplements before. It happened around the same time, and I ended up leaving and becoming head of, I guess it was chief scientific officer or something at the EAS, which was a very large supplement company one time.
Yeah.
And that didn't last too long because it just wasn't a right fit for me. And I was way too scientific.
What year was this?
They were a marketing company, not a, can have a lab or something like that. So
I don't know. And what year was this?
That would have been 90, 95.
Okay.
Wait a minute. Maybe early 96.
Okay.
So
was that then
I got,
sorry.
So then I got the opportunity to one of Dan's friends that knew a man out here in Illinois to come out here, and he was very vague about what this opportunity entailed. But I did come out here, and it was awkward because the person I was talking to never really told the guy out here in Illinois that I was coming. And he was like, who the hell are you? And I say, well, I just drove into town. I drove 1,000 miles. And I stayed at a hotel last night. And well, I'm skipping some details, but more or less that's how it went down. And he was like, well, there's a remnants of a lab here. I'm not going to pay you, but if you want to discuss projects that you want to undertake, that's fine. And whatever you need, as long as it's not too expensive, then we can get. So I...
Question.
Yeah, I started tinkering around with stuff, and I eventually, the pro homo thing happened. Let's just say that. That would maybe would have been a year or two after I first got here.
So was it Dan DeChain that got you the EAS position?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think he talked to them. And also Sean Phillips was on that, Bill Phillips' brother was on that discussion board. So he was someone that recognized me, and I started just having a discourse with him. And I think he was the one that suggested that they may like to have me work for them and develop products for them.
Yeah, was Dan involved personally with EAS, or did he just?
He was not with EAS per se, but with Muscle Media 2000, which was their magazine.
Yeah,
he was their number one writer, most popular writer, and he had a pretty decent contract.
Okay,
and then he went on to Muscular Development.
Yeah,
the Twin Lab magazine, and then they gave him even a bigger contract. No one writes for print magazines anymore.
Oh, no.
It was amazing how much money someone like Duchesne could make in print magazines back then.
Yeah.
Those days long old.
The lab that you turned up at and they didn't know you were coming, what were they doing there before you came?
Well, the man that had a business here, that business initially was involved agriculture, and he would engineer equipment or kind of turnkey series of equipment to turn things like soybeans or other ag products into usable foods, and he marketed these assembly line agricultural stuff. I don't know too much about it.
So they weren't doing supplements.
We're third world country. What's up?
So, but they weren't doing supplements or PEDs or anything vaguely like
no,
that.
No, he would never. He had nothing to do with supplements initially,
okay.
And he'd sell these things to third world countries. So he was traveling all over the place. And when I got here, I was here for a little while, and then he got back from Egypt from the worst trip of his life, and he was in no mood. And I was sitting at a desk that was actually a shrine to his mentor in college, a soy expert.
Yeah.
And he went to the secretary and say, who the hell is that at Professor whatever's desk? Yeah, so I didn't start off well off the bat. But the reason why he had a connection in the supplement industry is because there was a huge flood here in 1993.
A flood?
And one of his friends from University of Illinois had a business down in a suburb of St. Louis, and they did their own multi-level marketing supplement thing. So they also did contract manufacturing for a lot of companies, including Metrex and this one guy in San Francisco who was friends with Duchesne. So before the river got so high that it flooded his facility, he had all that equipment transferred up here to my current business partner's facility, and he took over the contract manufacturing business until that flood went away and they were able to get his building cleaned up. And yeah. So one of his clients was this guy, Stan, that was friends with Dan Duchesne, because he knew nothing about supplements or bodybuilding. And I came out here out of that connection. But he has a very open mind. So, he, you know, he said, okay, if you can find a way to make money, do it. And so we went down that road together. And it's been 22 years or something. I don't know how long. No, wait, I don't know. 1996.
That's almost 25 years.
That's a long time. 20, yeah.
So what is that, the Bar North America? Was that the name of the lab?
Bar North America was the name of the business that had the machine shop that made all the ag stuff for the third world countries, yes. But eventually, we started a separate business for the nutritional supplement stuff called LPG Research that later became Probiont Technologies, and now it's something else.
Okay.
There's our people are more familiar with our brand name subsidiaries like Ergo Farm, Keto Sports, than they are with, you know, like the parent company of all these.
Okay. So you started out a journey of synthesizing stuff in this lab, but did you have any like distribution network, or did you just start out making stuff?
I had developed such a following on the internet, and I started going to trade shows, and it wasn't very long until I was able to hook up, or we were able to hook up with the big distributors like Europa, and I don't know who else was around it in the late 90s, early 2000s. Plus, we had a joint venture with Metrex.
Okay.
We pour hormones under something called Substate Solutions.
Yeah.
So I got to meet a lot of contacts through them. And it was pretty easy entry back then into the market. And you could grow very quickly. It's nothing like that now. I would not recommend anyone get into the supplement industry if they think it's going to be more than, you know, very small level distribution and sales.
It's very competitive now.
Yeah, the regulations are just too much to overcome for a small company.
And mind you, it's much, much worse in Europe. It's much more tightly regulated in Europe than it is in the States now.
I know. We have to deal with trying to get our products through customs in many European countries. So we know.
Yeah. So what did you start out doing in the lab there?
Well, the first thing was this guy, Stan. Dan's friend wanted me to convert DHA acetate into DHEA. I don't know why. Well, probably because DHA acetate was the only form that China offered at the time.
Well,
it's an extremely simple thing to do. And by the time I said, okay, here it is, I can do it. China already had started offering regular DHEA, so But then I worked on conjugated linoleic acid, the cis-9 trans 11. I don't know if you remember what CLA was, but it was form of fatty acid, supposed to do body recomposition things.
Yeah.
And I did come up with a pretty nifty method to do that, but it was really nasty chemicals. And actually, I think it was Weider liked the sample I sent them because it was really highly pure. And we got a purchase order. Oh, I forgot.
For CLA?
What's that?
For CLA?
CLA. Yeah, for a certain amount of CLA.
Yeah.
We were able to get that and get a letter of credit from the bank, which allowed us to buy the equipment we needed to make that CLA. And that when we tried to do it on an industrial scale, it was a disaster.
Oh, no.
And I don't want to go into that. Later on, Stan, he had a company called Osmo, and he wanted me, he wanted to put together a kitchen sink creatine product, creatine plus whatever ingredients I can come up with. And I said, why don't you try androstenedione? Because I remember that from my days in New Jersey. As a precursor to testosterone, I figured, well, it could be, I knew it could be a prohormone to testosterone, just like DHEA was, although DHEA was never marketed as a prohormone. I kind of came up with at least the marketing concept of a prohormone. And Stan started selling that, but he ended up really ripping me off and ripping my business partner off. But that's when I decided to come up with poor androstenedione, which I think would be better.
Than DEH?
So that was the first prohormone from androstenedione.
Yeah.
I and my business partner here never sold androstenedione ourselves. Stan just sold it under his brand. But then we started making poor androstenedione from androstenedione, and then that really, we had a big falling out with Stan. Yeah, he ended up going to prison or something happened before he ever met us. But we started our own brand called Little Farm. And we sold 4-AD, and then we came up with other things. And it was around 2001 that I started making 1-AD, and that's the product that actually works on a level comparable to pharmaceutical anabolic steroids.
Yeah.
Yeah, and people that just skyrocketed so quickly. When people realized that it worked so well.
Yeah.
And that changed everything.
So pro-hormones were banned by the IOC in 1997. At what point did they become illegal in the States?
And that was...
You fell out there for a second. Can you repeat that?
Hold on a second. It was not until 2005.
Okay.
And it would have been some years earlier, but I enlisted the help of attorney Rick Collins, and then eventually got some other people from the industry on board. And Rick and I would go to Washington, D.C. and visit lobbyists and try to quell any support for some of the legislation that was being drafted up in committees.
Okay.
I think that may have had an impact of at least delaying the prohibition of pro-hormones until 2005.
Okay. So when did you...
But the thing is that there were left a lot of other pro-hormones and potential pro-hormones or people started to sell just designer steroids, more or less, over the counter. so they had to draft another bill in, it was 2011, and then another one. It was a cat and mouse game that became kind of ridiculous. But after 2005, we were out of the Pearl Hormone business, although we still had a product called 6-oxo, which was not a Pearl Hormone, but it was a estrogen synthesis inhibitor, also known as an aromatase inhibitor, which upregulates your body's own production of testosterone.
Yeah. Three questions actually. What was you mentioned the discussion board that you knew Dan Duchaine and the Phillips brothers from? Which one was that?
His brother Sean.
Yeah, but I mean, which discussion forum was it? Does it still exist?
Oh, it was called it was Miscellaneous Fitness Weights. It was a Usenet group. Okay. They don't have those anymore. No. It was a very cumbersome first generation discussion board.
Yeah.
Now they have, you know, real this stuff out there is a lot user friendly.
I remember using those for porn back in the day. what was the second question? The second question was, what kind of testing did you do on the products? Did you do any testing of the products on humans before releasing them? Or did you just trust them?
There were enough people around here in the gyms that were willing to try the things I made. And I tried many of them myself. And plus, our salesmen were out in California. They had other people that would try stuff.
Okay. But did you do anything?
And that was just to see how efficacious it was and to just make sure that there were no, you know, troublesome acute side effects.
Okay. But no formal inquiry into elevated liver enzymes or any other stuff like that.
Well, you can't really fund a $50,000 study on a product that. Well, I mean, the supplement industry is not the pharmaceutical industry.
Oh no.
So, yeah, but like I said, it was very loose back then, and if I was selling something that was that I thought the literature had any suggestion that there could be some troublesome toxicity to it, you know, I'd be very hesitant to put it on the market. But basically when it came to these pro hormones, if the side effects you'd see would be similar to those you would see with testosterone or anabolic steroids,
yeah.
You wouldn't expect a pro hormone to
Oh, no, I get that.
Give yep. you know, like a arthritis or edema in the brain or something.
Oh, no.
I don't know.
So, I mean, about the same time the pharmaceutical industry like had a resurgence in interest in anabolic drugs, and they tried to label like frailty or sarcopenia as independent conditions that deserve treatment. And I worked in the biomarker business with anabolic drugs, and a lot of drug development programs were started at that time with Ligand and Viking Pharma and GTX and Lilly and Pfizer, and that's when the whole selective androgen receptor modulator thing started. Doing this, I mean, the work you were doing were probably in parallel with what sort of happened at with some of the pharmaceutical companies. Were you ever in contact or approached by any of those?
No, but interesting enough, another chemical lab in this town was that I got connected to, and they helped me out with some stuff. They actually developed a facile synthesis for the SARM LGD. Oh, no, I'm sorry. Yeah, LGD 5-4. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Well, it's one of those SARMs. The company was called Ligand Pharmaceuticals. Yes. And he was actually, the guy that developed it was actually a professor here in town at University of Illinois.
Okay.
And they synthesized it. So, you know, I'm familiar with the people that actually did the hands-on work with at least one of the songs.
Yeah, I mean, I think Ligand made quite a few and licensed them to other countries, other companies.
Yeah, well, that's what usually these small pharmaceutical companies that do the initial research and fund maybe phase 1, phase 2 trials.
Yeah,
they eventually sell the technology to a much larger company like a Merck or Pfizer.
Yeah, yeah.
How they make the money?
Yeah, of course. Interesting. So you had brief contact with that kind of that part of the industry or whatever it's called.
Yeah, that, and I always thought that SARMs were a sort of a way for pharmaceutical companies to address muscle wasting without having to resort to anabolic steroids, which have such a stigma to them.
Yeah.
But let's face it, SARMs, they may be able, because they know a lot more about how androgens work on the cellular and nuclear level. They know the androgen response elements, and they can, when you got confined to the steroid substructure, you can get all kinds of crazy looking molecules using molecular mapping software. And you're able to get more selectivity as far as androgenic and anabolic effects go. But you're never going to get anabolic specificity.
No.
You know, it's the stuff is still going to manifest androgenic effects at a certain dose that's beyond the dose where it's more anabolic than androgenic. And I think that's where a lot of the bodybuilders have misconceptions, because they think that they can take a low androgenic drug at a high dose and still not get androgenic side effects. But that's not true, because above a certain threshold, you're going to get both.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, I think they had the, from a pharmacodynamics perspective, they had the proof of concept for SARMs from SERMs, where they had compounds, or where they have compounds that work as antagonists in uterine and breast tissue, but work as agonists in the rest of the body. I mean, if that's it's possible with SERMs, man. I mean, what is the? I can see why you'd want to make a drug that's an agonist in the muscle and bone, and an antagonist in everything else.
I don't think they ever developed a SARM that was like an agonist in muscle and an antagonist in prostate. However, I know that many of the SARMs actually started from a substructure of anti-androgens like flutamide, and they tinkered around with that to actually get agonists, and then they would just use computer simulation stuff to see how it would bind to the androgen receptor.
Yeah.
And then they would make dozens and dozens of variants until they came up with ones that met the criteria for marketing, which would be not too high of a dose, decent from pharmacokinetics, low toxicity, obviously. And
yeah.
And out of that, you know, there are many candidates, but even to this day, and people have been fooling around with this technology for a couple of decades at least.
Yeah.
And still, I don't think any one of them has actually been approved for sale.
No, you're right about that. I think the one made it to phase 3 and crashed there, and the other, I think two others went to phase 2, and the other one was close to phase 1. So, yeah. So about your comment, as far as the stigmatization of the term anabolic steroids, I mean, and I know that at least one of the SARMs is actually a steroid. I think the Merck Viking one, I can't remember what it's called these days, but that is actually a steroid. They're just calling it a SARM.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's kind of silly, but I get what why they're doing it.
Oh, I recall the one that you're talking about. I mean, it's highly tinkered with. It's got a lot of very strange functional groups on there, but it still has the same four ring substructure of a steroid.
Yeah. But I'm guessing SARM is more easy to swallow out there.
Yeah, and also, and it may escape, at least initially, immediate regulatory positioning along with other anabolic steroids.
Yeah,
but I don't see that being something that you know, I would think SARMs would suffer the same legal fate as anabolic steroids eventually, because they basically are anabolic steroids without being steroids.
I'm so happy you're saying that, because that's what I've been telling people here.
You've been trying to explain to people forever.
Yeah.
I understand.
When I was working in the biomarker business, we had collaborations with a number of these companies that did the SARMs, and I know that they tried to put a foot in the door by getting the SARMs approved for muscle wasting in cachexia, so when people had other conditions that kind of ate up their muscle mass. And I know that the long play from that was that if they could get approval for use in cachexia, they were trying to get approval in sarcopenia, where there are no, I mean, obvious accompanying diseases that cause the frailty. That was the long play, but they failed, and they all they couldn't get approval for anything, even for cachexia. The one that got the furthest was the one, the Ostarine or Enobosarm, that failed at a phase 3 trial as an accompanying treatment to non-small cell lung cancer. Where it, interestingly enough, it increased the muscle mass of the subjects, but it didn't increase the functionality.
Survival rate?
No. But they actually convinced the FDA to not. It would be good enough even if it didn't influence survival rate. It just, they had to influence muscle mass and strength. And the strength test they utilized in this was some kind of stair test. They had to climb 10 flights, 10 steps of stairs in time, and they didn't see any functional improvement on that parameter. And that, but they did seem to grow muscle, but they didn't get any stronger, you know, at least in terms of this stair test, and then they failed.
Well, that test may involve too much of a cardiovascular component, which, you know, anabolic steroids, I don't know, especially if you're talking about or lung disease.
I mean, there's a couple of other studies that have shown with testosterone administration to, if people are not doing too well, that is actually something that has been seen in a couple of studies, that even when they administered androgens, anabolic androgens, and growing muscle, they don't, I mean, if they're not very healthy, it's there's a couple of other studies that show the same thing, that they don't get any stronger.
And a lot of people that have used steroids and work out and have ever tried using steroids without working out, if you don't exercise, you may gain some weight, but you'll still won't gain that much muscle, and you won't really get that much stronger. You still need the stimulus of resistance exercise to manifest the strength benefits.
Yeah. But it's a little bit weird, but that's just so they all failed. And after the last one failed, I think the whole SARM thing, at least from the perspective of the pharmacological industry, that kind of faded out. Det var altså historien om, hvordan Patrick Arnold blev endt med at være en slags ophavsmand af hele fænomenet prohormoner på dopingscenen. Her i det næste segment, der skal vi høre om hans, hvad kan man sige, næste engagement i dopingverdenen, og det handler om, hvordan han blev fittet ind i det, der hedder, det man kender som Balco-skandalen. Det står for The Bay Area Lab Company, som var den største, nok har været den største organiserede dopingsag sådan i USA's historie. Og der var en bagmand, der hed Victor Conte, der stod bag, som var sådan lidt en brugtvognsforhandler-type, som har haft en biks hvor at han har solgt mineral, vitamin og mineralkosttilskud til atleter, til sportsfolk, og han har også lavet sådan noget med at få taget blodprøver på dem, så han kunne fortælle dem, hvad for nogle vitaminer og mineraler de manglede at tage. Og han lavede det her dopingprogram, hvor man signede op som sådan en abonnementsting, og så fik man man fik væksthormon, og man fik som væksthormon, som gør, at det ikke sådan i praksis, så det ikke er, så det ikke rigtig vævsopbyggende, men det gør beskytter muligvis mod skader og gør, at man sådan har det rart. Og der var EPO i, som gør, at man fik en højere hematokrit, og man ikke længere blev forpustet af de samme ting, altså fik en højere ildoptagelse. Der var modafinil, som er et stof, der bruges som nootropic, som egentlig er noget narkolepsi-medicin, men som virker stimulerende, så man ikke så let bliver træt, og ikke så let, altså hverken søvnig, men heller ikke mærker fysisk træthed på helt samme måde. Så var der en testosteron, epitestosteron-gel, som supplerede folk op i testosteron, og der var også et andet stof, der hed epitestosteron. Og formålet med det her epitestosteron, det er egentlig at snyde dopingtesten. Forstået sådan, at når man laver en dopingtest, så kigger man i første omgang på forholdet mellem testosteron og epitestosteron i dopingprøven. Fordi det her forhold, det skal være under 4-1. Og en almindelig voksen mand, så er det cirka 1-1. Og når man så tager testosteron, så øges den her ratio. Og hvis den kommer over 4-1, og dengang der var ratioen, man der udløste en og sådan videre, vidste ikke 4-1, der var det vist 6 eller 8-1 i virkeligheden. Men så sendte man det videre til noget, der hedder Carbon Isotope Ratio Analysis, hvor man kan se, om det her testosteron, der er tilført, om det kommer udefra. Men det er også sådan, at hvis man så tilfører epitestosteron samtidig med, så kan man tage højere doser af testosteron, før man tester positiv. Så det var det, der var meningen med det. Og så ud over det, så var der et tredje derude, og det var ligesom nogle derude, de havde opdaget, som ikke blev fanget af den almindelige dopingtest. Og det første af dem, det var et, der hedder norboleton, som Patrick han fortæller lidt om. De prøvede på at bruge et andet, der hedder madol, også kaldt DMT. Og det sidste, så var der noget, der hedder THG fra tetrahydrogestrinon. Og hele Balkov-skandalen, den blev slået op ved, at en atletiktræner havde fået adgang til en sprøjte med det her THG, som man sendte ind til de amerikanske antidopingmyndigheder. Altså hos de amerikanske antidopingmyndigheder, USADA, deres chef, dopingjæger dengang, det var en fyr, der hed Don Catlin, som er forsker og antidoping, jeg arbejder med antidopingforskning, og det var egentlig ham, der var involveret i at opdage både det her norboleton og tetrahydrogestrinon. Så her kommer versionen af, eller der kommer Patrick Arnolds version af den historie. Desværre så måtte han stoppe interviewet her lidt tidligt, og håber på, at i det andet afsnit af Fitness MK, hvor vi skal snakke med Patrick Arnold, at vi kan gå lidt dybere ind i nogle af de her historier fra Balco-skandalen, den kommer her. The whole Balco story, which is a fascinating story in itself, how did that begin for you? Did Victor Conde reach out to you, or how did that happen?
Yes, it was I ran into Victor on the same miscellaneous fitness weights group that I ran into Dan Duchesne, but this was in 2000.
Yeah.
And he used to talk about his DMA product, and he angered a lot of people because everyone would get into debates with him, and he was supporting
Victor Conte.
His science. Victor Conte, yeah. He owned Balco and had a supplement called VMA, which is a zinc magnesium supplement. It's still very popular today.
Yeah, I get it. Yeah,
it's not a bad product as far as it provides zinc and magnesium in a very bioavailable form. But he was talking about raises testosterone, and he was putting down my pro hormones, saying, "No, you should take ZMA instead." And I'm like, "You can't even compare it." And then one day he sent me a private email to tell me about pro hormones and can athletes take them, and if they make you test positive, what is the clearance time? And he's asking me, and I'm like, well, and then I told him, because I'd already been making some stuff called Mabolathone and distributing it to some athletes around the world and trainers, but they were small scale and they were very discreet.
Yeah.
And I told Victor, there's this stuff I can send it to you. You can he said, well, I have a guy at the UCLA lab that can verify if the stuff is undetectable. So I sent him some, and his people got very good results, and the urine samples came back clear. That's why he called that and the subsequent products the clear.
Yeah.
If you remember. And so I started selling him Narbolathone, and then his spy or contact within the lab said that they're onto Narbolathone, stop using it. So then I developed THG, which is made from gestinone, which is an endometriosis drug.
Yeah.
And that was even stronger.
Yeah.
And was even not just something they didn't test for, but it actually disintegrated in the current instrumentation that they used at the time, which was tandem GC mass spec. And they actually had to switch to liquid chromatography mass spec to get over that problem. I didn't really know that at the time, but two things is that Victor let himself get into infighting too much. Like, he's had a falling out with a track coach, and he also just told everyone in the world what he was doing. he would throw boxes of syringes and all kinds of stuff into his dumpster, and people would see athletes come and go out of his place. And he also would say, Patrick, don't forget to delete your emails, as though deleting your emails from your computer is going to remove any trace of evidence.
Wow,
and I was like, Victor, it doesn't work that way. They can still find. He was the worst criminal in the world. best salesman and marketer, but the worst freaking criminal in the world.
About the synthesis of a Narbolathone, was that something that you came up with yourself, or was it something you found in the old patent databases?
No, I came up with it myself. Although later on, it was an obvious synthesis because there was a side group that had a triple bond on it. And there was, and I knew that if I did a selective catalytic hydrogenation, that I could reduce that to a single bond ethyl group without affecting any of the bonds within the four ring basic steroid structure. And that's just because they're more kindred. And when you take a progestin with acetylenic, something alpha group, and I know this is probably way over everyone's heads, but you know a little bit of chemistry.
Yeah.
And you can selectively reduce the triple bond to a single bond.
Yeah.
And then you come up with basically a 19 oral 19 nor. A good example would be a drug called Nylavar or Esandrolone.
Yeah.
That was marketed in Europe at one time. And that's actually, you can make that from a norethindrone, which is a very widely available progestin. And just like I made Narbolathone from levonorgestrel, which is a widely available birth control agent, and THG was made from gestinone, which has the same basic structure, but is a trenbolone-like triene structure within the rings.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Hold on, I'm still on the.
Come again.
That's all. My business partner came in.
Oh, sorry.
What time is it? Because I have to. Do you know what time it is? All right, we're okay. So where were we?
I was going to ask about desoxymethyl testosterone, the other DMT you made. I thought that was in between Narbolathone and THG.
Also known as Madol. No, yeah. That was completely different. That was a C19 steroid, not an 18 nor. And that was actually made from epiandrosterone. It's sort of a, I can't remember the structure. It had a, it didn't have any, I'll just, you can have to edit that out because I got to sort of remember. It's I guess you could call it a DHT derivative.
But
it has a very strange structure in the A ring. There's a, it's just one double bond from between position two and position three. Yeah. And it's also a 17 alpha methyl. And it was, the literature suggested that it was very effective and it's strong and it was. And it actually ended up being sold as a nutritional supplement after the whole Balco thing. But Victor had never gotten to the point where he used it on athletes because he had done some testing, but by the time before he was able to actually institute into his program that he used with his athletes, he got busted. So
okay. Did you have any hand in designing the program that he used? Like which drugs?
I gave him suggestions on certain dosing, and then he kind of figured it out himself. And I also told him about the formula, how to make a topical epitestosterone preparation, which would normalize people's test epi ratio, because yeah. when people would take these strong anabolic drugs, that would drive their testosterone down so low that you would get very strange results in the test epi ratio.
Yeah.
So he needed to artificially raise the test and epi in the blood so that it wouldn't signal any red flags. And then there was a pharmacist friend in Texas that started making the cream for him. And then he had one of his friends make it. But other than that, I just gave him general suggestions. And then he took it upon himself to methodically, I guess, test different dosages and he seemed to be pretty good at that. You know, he was well organized and he kind of knew what he was doing when it came to that. He ended up doing a good job. He just talked too much about it. Anderson, I'm going to have to leave.
Okay.
Pretty soon. I have a doctor's appointment.
Okay, sure.
I hope you have enough information. If you want to follow up on anything, just let me know. We can.
Sure. I mean, if we can do a follow up and finish up, I think we have another 20 minutes or something worth of questions. If you've got a time another day, it would be really nice.
Yeah, let's just talk. Via Facebook Messenger. We'll figure out a time next week or something.
Okay, excellent. Let's do that. Det var altså det, vi kunne nå om Balco-skandalen i den her omgang. Tidligere interviewet med ham, der fortalte han lidt om noget af det flak, han fik bagefter Balco-skandalen. Og det tænkte jeg, det kunne vi lige sætte ind her bagefter. Og det handler jo om, at efter den, der arbejdede med at lave et kosttilskud, der hed 6-oxo. 6-oxo, det er det, der kaldes en aromatasehæmmer. Aromatase, det er et enzym, der laver testosteron og testosteron i kroppen. Og det har vi sammen. Og man har fundet ud af, at ved at hæmme den her omdannelse af østrogen, så kan man faktisk hæmme testosteronniveauet. Og det har noget at gøre med den her feedback-akse, der er med til at kontrollere, hvor meget testosteron vi har i kroppen. Og der fortæller han ligesom om, hvordan de blev ramt i røven. At der var sådan et boomerang-effekt af, at han var begyndt at få sådan et blakket ry. Og det kommer her.
That got me in big trouble.
Yeah.
It put me on the radar with not only the US government, but also World Anti-Doping Agency, United States Anti-Doping Agency. Yeah. And that has, I got in trouble for that and sentenced to a short prison term and probation. But it also resulted in a drug enforcement agency action on our company, on our 6-Oxo product that was kind of conjured up. And I think it was people in the World Anti-Doping Agency that prompted the DEA and the FDA to come after us because they said that there was a contamination of androstenedione, which at that time was a controlled substance in our 6-Oxo.
Yeah.
But they led the DEA to believe that it was a significant amount and it was put on there on purpose, and neither was the case. So they really came and messed everything up for us. They had to shut down our facility that we built from the ground up. It was state of the art. And we couldn't sell 6-Oxo anymore. And that was our main source of income. Mm. And we had to, that was a period of readjustment. And now I'm still around, but doing stuff on a much smaller scale. They did everything they could to try to find, to get something indictable out of their raid and all the documents that they took. But they were completely wrong and what they thought was going on.
But this is somewhat later, right?
This is public, yeah. I mean, because this was 2009.
Okay.
And it was 5 years later that I got an email saying that they were closing the book on the case because by then the statute of limitations had run out and they had found no evidence that could lead to an indictment of a felony. Maybe they said, oh, maybe there's some misdemeanor things here. But by that time, we had lost everything we had built up and just had to retreat back to the original place that we started in a small town out in the middle of nowhere. But we're still doing stuff.
Yeah, so they confiscate your lab equipment?
No, they didn't confiscate any equipment. They confiscated all the 6-Oxo inventory, and they took evidence, took a lot of files. But no, they sort of shut the building down for temporarily, but we had to auction off most of our equipment because of the fact that we weren't able to make anything and sell anything anymore.
Okay.
Especially 6-Oxo, which was our breadwinner.
Okay. But I mean, according to WADA, aromatase inhibitors by default is considered a doping agent now. So, is it that illegal in the States now, at what point did it become so?
It never became illegal.
Okay.
However, the FDA kind of made it clear without being implicit or explicit about it. That if I ever tried to sell it again, you know, they would break down doors and put me in handcuffs.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's that was a big pet peeve for them because a baseball player had what they call a positive for androstenedione, and then they blamed it on 6-Oxo. And I really think that that was a load of baloney, but.
Yeah.
That embarrassed Major League Baseball in a big way. And that was the second time I had embarrassed Major League Baseball. And I don't think they weren't going to let me get away with it.
Og det var det sidste, som vi kunne nå med Patrick Arnold i det her afsnit af Fitness MK. Jeg arbejder stadigvæk på at få rundet den sidste del af hans historie af, så vi kan høre lidt mere om Balco-skandalen, og selvfølgelig høre om hans historie med det her DMAA-stimulans, som der gav en masse ballade i pre-workout-branchen. Men forhåbentlig så er det næste afsnit. Hvis ikke, så er det næste afsnit igen. Han er lidt svær at fange. Ja, det var simpelthen dagens afsnit af Fitness.mk. Det var afsnit nummer fucking 300. Jeg er glad for, at I følger med, og jeg prøver på at blive ved med at lave noget til jer, som jeg selv synes er sjovt at lave, og som I forhåbentlig synes er sjovt at lytte til. Så sådan er det. Du har lyttet til Fitness.mk, og jeg hedder Anders Nedergaard. Du kan lytte med til den her og de andre episoder af Fitness.mk via stream og podcast. Du kan streame det fra andersnedergaard.dk eller fra Spreaker, og du kan podcaste fra alle de store podcasttjenester. Programmet er produceret af Jonas Pedersen, og jeg skal velkommen til at skrive ind til os, og det kan man på afn@andersnedergaard.dk eller på vores Facebook-side eller Instagram-side. Det hedder Fitness.mk.